Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Welcome to what will be one of the more interesting of the Dr. Peter Bregan Hours with an outstanding guest from Australia. John, are you there?
I am.
I hear you. Can you hear me pretty clearly?
Yes.
Okay. Well, before going on to tell you exactly who this is coming from Australia, we have a new study out in the British Medical Journal that shows that the antidepressant reduction that occurred for a few years in regard to children resulted in a increase in suicidality. That's the headline. It's a good journal, BMJ, better than most. Well, what's the matter with this? I mean, is this really true that here, when in 2004 the FDA warnings came out and there was a reduction in antidepressant usage, that the suicide rates went up for children? Well, no. You know, you wonder how this stuff gets published. First of all, there's a peak in suicide that occurs 2 years earlier. Then, in fact, during the critical 2004, which is when all this data is coming out from the FDA, into early 2005, and the reduction in antidepressant use starts, there's a reduction in the suicide rate. And then within a couple of years, there's a rise in the suicide rate again. But it's for all ages. So they've just got to fiddle around with the data. It's just a disgrace. You wonder how in the world journals keep publishing this stuff. But we do have some idea of why they do. Not long ago, in this past year, the British Medical Journal did a study, published a study that was critical of the outcome results with the anti-cholesterol drugs, these hugely remunerative drugs. And the journal just got hit so hard by the drug companies that there had to be, you know, write-in campaigns to protect it and so on. So the journals live in fear of the drug companies. And my guest today is going to be able to tell you a lot about it. He knows stuff I don't know, and he's done some interesting things. His name is John Giuridini. Let me spell his last name for you, Giuridini. John's a child psychiatrist. He's at the Women and Children's Hospital in Adelaide, Australia, where he works with ill and disabled children. He's also trained in philosophy, and he's a professor in the disciplines of psychiatry and pediatrics at the University of Adelaide. He's also the spokesman for Healthy Skepticism. You can find that easily on the web, Healthy Skepticism, where he writes incisively. He has a variety of different interests that will come up during the show. One that I'm interested in, that I actually never got to chat with him about, is his work with Siblings Australia, which is advocates for individuals with ill and disabled siblings. I think that could be very interesting. I probably first heard about John in 2004 when he published as a lead author an excellent article on the efficacy and safety of antidepressants for children and adolescents. And I think it's fair to say he found them neither safe nor efficacious. It was an excellent article published in the BMJ. So things go up and down at the BMJ and in the publishing industry in general, but I guess BMJ is among the best. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I didn't mention that John's also an author on Mad in America. Many of the people who come on this show have an affiliation with Mad in America. Did you happen to get a chance to look at that BMJ article that just came out? I meant to ask you about it, and I would think you hadn't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, I have seen it. I think what's really interesting about it is that the people who've been opposed caution about the use of antidepressants in children have always said, well, you're basing your arguments that antidepressants are dangerous just on suicide attempts and suicidal thinking. And when you look at completed suicide, there's no difference. So therefore we should continue to use antidepressants. Now in this study, there was an association between reduced prescribing and suicide ideas and attempts, but not completed suicide. So suddenly they've reversed their argument and said that, well, it doesn't matter that there was no difference in completed suicides. There was a change in attempted suicides and suicidal ideas. So that means these drugs are dangerous. So, you know, it really is a matter of cherry-picking the data to find out which bits of it suit your argument and then to adjust the presentation of the data accordingly. We know from a long history of looking at studies which look for associations between prescribing patterns and various outcomes in the population, that this doesn't tell us anything about causal relationships. There are so many other possible explanations for why the figures might change. I could equally well carry out a study which demonstrated that there wasn't an association if I spun it in the right direction. So this study really tells us nothing one way or the other.
You know, it's thank you for that additional point. And, you know, it's so interesting because supposedly the gold standard in the profession is the controlled clinical trial. And the reason they've made that the gold standard, from my viewpoint, is because they're drug company controlled by and large. So they want you to rely on the controlled clinical trials. Nonetheless, controlled clinical trials do at least try to limit the variables by having an identical or nearly identical control group so that you can actually say if there's a change between two groups, it's the presence or absence of the drug versus the placebo. And when you do that, it's very straightforward, even in these very poorly done studies for the FDA that weren't intended to look for suicidality, you get a doubling of the suicidality rate in the controlled clinical trials, the gold standard. So then when that happens, everybody suddenly decides, no, pro-drug people, we're going to do these epidemiological studies where things are constantly changing. I mean, the economy has been just going downhill throughout the world during this period of time, for example. You know, the motivations are just so bad. You know an awful lot about that, John. Do you want to talk some more about that, just how the drug companies manipulate the data?
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry my handpiece is playing up, so I'm having to go on speaker. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you okay on speaker. That's fine. I'm just glad we could coordinate times, and you being smarter than me and more mathematical managed to call in at the right time. It's a 12, almost a 12, roughly a 12-hour difference, folks. But it's on the half hour, which is just very strange to me.
It is strange. We're one of the few places in the world that's half an hour out of kilter with everybody else.
But a wonderful country, Australia. You did studies on Paxil and how they falsely publish studies, again, on this theme of pharmaceutical companies just doing anything to distort data.
Yeah, I mean, the actual study in children was a particularly cynical example of data manipulation and, you know, plain out lying about what had happened in the study. What they did was they got their results back, which showed no difference between paroxetine or Paxil and placebo in the treatment of depression in adolescents. So not satisfied with that negative result, they changed the interpretation of what the primary outcome was in a cynical and misleading way to pretend that, or give the impression that, one of the primary outcomes had been positive. And they buried a great number of suicidal outcomes in the Paxil group by referring to them as emotional lability, which no ordinary person would assume meant that the people had sometimes made very dangerous suicide attempts.
No, it's like Prozac did the same thing. When they would get a report from an investigator, when Eli Lilly would get a report from an investigator of a suicide or a suicide attempt, they'd call it no drug effect, or they'd call it emotional lability, but they would not call it a suicide attempt. And there was actually a memo sent to the head offices from some of the researchers for Eli Lilly in Germany saying, you know, how am I going to explain this to my family? How am I going to explain this to a judge? But we'll do what you tell us, a very familiar theme.
It is, but I think the notion that, I don't know where it originally came from, but Peter Mansfield, the chair of an organization called Healthy Skepticism, taught it to me, the notion of golden handcuffs. So if you pay people a lot of money, they get used to having a lot of money, and they can't probably get it elsewhere, so they find themselves doing things that they wouldn't ordinarily do.
Yes. You know, and one of the things that we don't even much talk about when we look at these studies, like the Paxil study that actually didn't show a difference in improvement, but they claimed did show, and that is that compared to the placebo, these drugs are terrible for children. So we're not even counting that. There's no discussion of that in the new BMJ article, that children on these drugs are developing loss of sexuality, sexual dysfunction, that may persist throughout adulthood. Many studies are showing sexual dysfunction is not recoverable in many, many cases. These children are developing mania and hypomania. There are studies from a variety of sources showing 30, 40, 50% of children on antidepressants are developing overstimulation with aggressivity and violence and just generally disturbed behaviors, however you measure them. And there's no discussion in this BMJ article, as I recall, of weighing these flimsy claims for improvement on the drug, on the suicide rate, which really isn't so, but they're not even looking at what the cost side is in terms of disrupted behavior. Also, these kids become more and more used to psychiatric drugs. They get more drugs for their adverse effects. They end up as lifetime career drug users. So, I mean, it's just amazing how sterile all this stuff is, John. Just amazing. Are you seeing any changes going on? Are things getting at all better?
Sorry, I missed that.
Are you seeing any changes? Here in the U.S., we're at least seeing some growing public skepticism. Are you seeing changes in Australia?
Well, the prescribing figures in Australia have just come out for psychiatric drugs in general in for children, and they're continuing to climb at a very significant rate. So, you know, maybe it would be worse if people weren't speaking out against it. There certainly is a lot of people who are very sceptical about the use of
these drugs in children in Australia, but that doesn't seem to be stopping the prescribing figures from increasing.
Yeah, that really is a shame. How is your work greeted in Australia?
Mostly fairly positively, I think. I mean, the key opinion leaders don't like it very much. I don't know whether your listeners are familiar with that idea of the mostly very senior people in medicine, particularly in psychiatry, who are in partnerships with industry and may not realise it, but act as a very important part of the marketing arm of the pharmaceutical industry. The notable figures in Australia don't like me, and they are the people who've got the public voice. They've got government ear. So I wouldn't really think that, you know, by the establishment, I think I'm regarded probably like you are, as a bit of a freak.
Now, I don't remember being called a freak recently, but certainly as a bit dangerous. I think I prefer to see myself as being seen as a bit dangerous to the drug companies, which we both very much are. You've been doing work with trying to get providers to give children other services other than drugs. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, a number of years ago, when I was talking to groups of GPs, family doctors who are the main prescribers of psychiatric drugs rather than psychiatrists, just because they're much more numerous, when I was talking to them about why they shouldn't use antidepressants in children, it was relatively easy to convince them of that. But they understandably came up with the response, well, if we don't use antidepressants, what do we do? And so we took that as a bit of a challenge and worked with some family doctors to develop a training program, a one-day training for GPs in child and adolescent mental health, that we took a number of approaches in that. The first was sort of being very sceptical about diagnosis and wanting to understand the young person's predicament rather than make a diagnosis. Second, to think that primary care settings were not a second-rate version of psychiatry whereby you went to a family doctor if you couldn't get in to see a child psychiatrist. But in fact, for the vast majority of young, distressed people, you got better care in primary care than you did from mental health services. And the third issue was really about exploiting and celebrating not just the placebo effect, but the whole effect of watchful waiting, of sitting with kids and their families and listening carefully to what they had to say, helping them make sense of it, but not being in a rush to actually do anything, let alone prescribe, and to supplement that approach with simple, supportive and actually strongly evidence-based interventions that can be carried out in general practice, you know, like exercise programs, journaling, a range of other generally health-enhancing interventions rather than health-damaging interventions like medication that prove to be useful in this in this population.
So were the actual MD providers trying to do this kind of supportive and helpful therapy?
Yes, well, we've had very receptive audiences. I mean, these things are enormously difficult to evaluate because it's hard, you know, you can ask people, as we do, you know, several weeks after the training program, you know, whether they've changed their practice and those kinds of things, and we get positive responses to those kinds of questionnaires, but that's of limited meaning. What we'd really want to do, if we could establish it on a wide enough scale, is check and see what happens to the kids in the practices. But as you can imagine, that's our multi-million-dollar study that we're not set up to be able to do.
Now, you have national health care in Australia, so that they, how are the doctors paid? How does it affect their pay to spend more time with a child? In this country, it's a real financial issue for these doctors to sit around talking with a family, which is the most useful thing. How does it affect their income?
If you're a family doctor, the way to absolutely maximize your income is to see people for 4 or 5 minutes. But it is financially viable to mix the 5-minute consultation with 20 minutes and 30-minute consultations. So you do get support for that. And our program is specifically designed so that you can do it in 20-minute sessions. We don't, we've pared back the assessment process to what we see as the core minimal assessment that allows you to make a safe and responsible decision about what is appropriate for that young person. And we capitalise on the fact that family doctors don't just have one go with their patients, that people tend to come back, be comfortable coming back to their local doctor if they need to. So, it does place a small financial stress on doctors to adopt this more ethical approach to child and adolescent mental health, but it's not like in America where you're very strongly financially penalised for it.
Do you work with a family concept? From my viewpoint, what ails children is usually the adults in their lives, in addition to just problems in human life and human nature, but that the real help comes from helping the adults. Is that a part of the model?
Yeah, so we say to GPs that there are 4 or 5 critical questions that you need to be able to answer to make sense of the young person's predicament. So what we talk to GPs about is the I get it experience, or the light bulb moment, where suddenly the apparently inexplicable symptoms in the child, whether it's behaviour problems or depression, make sense. You know, it might be something as relatively straightforward as uncovering domestic violence in the family, or it might be something like recognising that the child has a language disorder. And we say that in order to reach that I get it experience, the two of the questions that are most critical to answer are who's who and what's the story. And the who's who question is really answered by doing a genogram or family tree. And in my view, that's the single most informative intervention in terms of assessment that's available in health or, counselling in general. I'm always saying to medical students that I would like to fail you if you don't do a genogram on every person that you see. And in the process of drawing that family tree, you uncover, I think in at least half of cases, by the time you've done the family tree, you really know what's going on and what the predicament is for the young person, in a way that you don't if you carry out some kind of rote diagnostic assessment.
Can you give an example of the kinds of things you see in a family tree?
For example, you discover that that this is not the first marriage, that the child who's been brought along has a different father, that the child unfortunately reminds the mother of his father, the previous husband, who's been an unpleasant person in some way, and that's unspoken. She's ashamed of the fact that she can't really love this child like she does the others because of the association with the father. And a sensitive, in the process of doing a genogram sensitively, that very complex and unexpected set of circumstances might emerge. A young girl I was interviewing recently, very abrasive little girl who didn't want to be there, but I was able to hold her in the interview doing the genogram because it gives you a tool to kind of keep going with the interview in the face of somebody being, frankly, in this case, frankly rude and dismissive. I noticed that when I asked her about her grandparents, her whole manner softened, and it turned out that her grandmother had bowel cancer, and that something that was driving her hostile and aggressive behavior was the fact that she was extremely anxious about her grandmother's welfare and couldn't really talk about that. That never would have emerged, I don't think, if I hadn't have drawn a family tree.
Yeah. I think all over the world, those of us who are really thinking about children and caring about them just increasingly see the family as the unit and not the child as the isolated patient. But boy, it is hard, isn't it, to turn pediatricians and child psychiatrists and even family docs away from just seeing the child as the, quote, issue, having a disorder.
Because you also get into the situation of being seen as being a parent blamer. You know, we've got a terrible history of that in psychiatry, of, the schizophrenogenic mother and all that kind of stuff. So, there's a fine line between recognizing the vital importance of the family and its influence on children and its capacity to heal children, and being portrayed as blaming the parents for, you know, it obviously suits in many situations to think, well, this is not your fault, it's ADHD, or depression's a chemical imbalance, it's got nothing to do with what's happening in the person's life. You can understand how distressed and unhappy people see that as a kind of refuge against their probable self-blame that they've been engaging in about what's happened to their children.
You know, one of the things I tell parents is that we're not going to really focus on what anybody did wrong, because what I really know is that the parents have in their power to help heal their children. So I want to get to work really quickly on what it is that the parents need to do and the children need to do to heal the family. And that's where most of my emphasis goes. Along the way, people will learn they made mistakes because they'll be seeing the alternatives. But I think it's so much better for people to be focused on what they can do to make things better. Guilt stifles growth and stifles love. Just doesn't help at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us more about your work. We've got about 2 minutes, actually. Why don't we lay out a little bit about what we'll talk about when we come back? You're doing a lot of different things. What would you like to talk about when we get through the half hour?
I wonder whether we might talk a bit about your new book that's coming out, and we may have a bit of a disagreement here, so that might be interesting for the listeners.
I don't want to jump ahead on that. I haven't been talking about my new book yet. So we'll talk about that privately, and my listeners will be hearing in good...
About
go ahead.
Maybe if I could say something about letting children cry.
Yes.
And if you want me to talk about the siblings stuff, I could talk about that. And we could talk about the fact that ethics-based medicine is something that we should see as being more central than evidence-based medicine.
Good. I think that's a very, very good idea. Folks, I do have a new book coming out in December, and it's about guilt, shame, and anxiety. I think you can advance order it, actually, on Amazon at this point. But I'm not devoting much, as you know, anybody who listens to the show, I'm not sure I've even mentioned it before. But we'll be getting to talk about that, particularly in December when it comes out. I don't want to weaken the excitement when the book is actually viable and available. And we'll be offering off my website later on a really nice deal for the book. But I do want John's feedback on it, because I can still modify some of the book in response to criticism. Well, we're talking with John Ciriadini, and he's a child psychiatrist in Adelaide, Australia. We'll go to break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about the innovative work he's doing in the field. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. I am back with John Ciriadini, professor of child psychiatry, all the way from Australia, from Adelaide, Australia. And one of the things he and I were just chatting about during the break, well, let me spell his name again for you, Ciriadini. You can find him on the web, and you can also look up his site, Healthy Skepticism. John was talking about psychiatric interventions and autonomy and what works. And why don't you just pick up on that and just talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, well, you know, we know, this makes some people sad, that therapeutic interventions in psychiatry and psychology are all pretty much the same in terms of their efficacy, apart from, you know, doing something that's frankly idiotic, as some people do, sadly, whether it's CBT or psychoanalysis or, ordinary practice, the majority of people get better. Most interventions that we have small to moderate effect sizes, so they do some good. But none of them are spectacular, and certainly none are demonstrably better than any others. So the negative way of looking at that is that we're pretty hopeless at everything we do. The positive part of it is that what we can abstract out of that observation is that what really matters in psychiatry and psychology is the therapeutic relationship between, in our case, doctor and patient. And rather than feeling bad about that, we should celebrate it and do what we can to enhance the quality of that therapeutic relationship. So we don't have evidence to guide us about which is the best approach to take. So evidence-based practice only really helps us to exclude those things that we shouldn't do that are demonstrated to be dangerous. And one of those would be using antidepressants in young people. So really what we're after is evidence-constrained, not evidence-based medicine, because evidence shows us a small range of things that we have at our disposal which are roughly equally likely to be effective. Therefore, we should make our decision about which of those interventions we choose on ethical grounds, which of these interventions is least likely to be harmful. So most often that will lead us not to choose a medication alternative where there's a non-medication alternative because the harms of medication are significant. That's not to dismiss the harms of other kinds of therapy. There's a long and sad history of boundary violations in psychotherapy that have done terrible damage to people. So I'm not saying that, all talking therapy is good and all drug therapy is bad. The guiding principle that I try to follow is, what is it that I can do that is going to least interfere with this patient's autonomy? So it's really quite a minimalist approach. What's the least I can do? Which we really need to distinguish from laziness or sloppiness, because actually it takes quite a lot of clinical maturity to do less rather than more. Always in my mind is, what effect is it going to have on the patient's autonomy? Because we psychiatrists, on average, take autonomy away from our patients. There are many patients in psychiatric hospitals who are on involuntary treatment orders of various kinds, but there are many more people in psychiatric hospitals who are called voluntary patients but are only there because there's some explicit or implicit threat that if they don't cooperate, they'll be made involuntary. So that's hanging over us all the time. If I sit with a patient in a consulting room as a psychiatrist, might that patient be thinking, well, if I don't do what the doctor says, I'm going to be made to do it, So as psychiatrists, we always have to operate conscious of our coercive potential for patients and try to operate in a way that increases the choices and the control they have over their life rather than decreases it. And that might that might sometimes be at the expense of increasing symptoms. So I might be working with my patient and encouraging them to tolerate more symptoms in their life because I think that they're leading a fuller and more autonomous life with that level of symptoms than they would be if they did something like take a drug that might take away those symptoms.
I like very much what you're saying. I think the autonomy issue is so central. You know, buried deep in my past, John, I wrote a paper in 1963 for the Archives of General Psychiatry on the coercion of voluntary patients on a supposedly open hospital ward. And another of my early papers was on the ethics of psychoanalysis. So and psychotherapy. So it's really, we share a lot of common views about that. And you were saying
wanting to be gratuitous to thank you for Toxic Psychiatry because reading that book changed my practice quite radically.
I didn't know that, John. You know, so many of my guests say that, and I didn't know that. Tell me a little about that. We didn't talk about that. Did you read it back in 91 or 2 when it came out?
Not long after it came out, maybe a couple of years after that. I was a social work colleague of mine. We'd been talking, I mean, obviously had the seed of these kinds of skeptical ideas about psychiatry already. I think every healthy psychiatrist does. But reading your book just completely opened my eyes to the scope of the overt and covert corruption in what we do, and our need to be constantly vigilant that we don't behave in that kind of way.
Well, I'm very, very glad to hear that. I'm actually a little surprised. I had no idea that that you'd read my work early on in your career. That's wonderful. You know, I'm 78 now, and it's very gratifying to see the effects that my books have had on the professionals and therefore on just, I guess, millions of patients, directly or indirectly. It's really, really nice. Thank you. You were also talking during the break, we were talking about guilt and shame, and you were saying that in some ways it's positive to feel guilt and shame. I'd like to hear from you about that.
Now, I've got a paper coming out soon in the local medical journal of Australia called Let Children Cry. I think as a society, we're intolerant of strong feelings, particularly in young people. We don't like to see our children unhappy or angry or frightened, and that's obviously perfectly reasonable, but I think we underestimate their capacity to tolerate and grow from having strong negative feelings and going through through unpleasant times in their lives, particularly in adolescence. And I think, you know, there's a real thing in Australia at the moment, a conflation between two populations of young people. There are 1-2% of young people who need to see people like you and me who are very incapacitated by what, you know, might amount to a mental disorder. But when they do community surveys about mental disorder, they come up with figures like 20 or 25% of young people have had significant episodes of distress over the last year. And what happens is that those two populations get conflated. The 20% get talked about as though they're as severely impaired as the 2%. And a lot of those 20% of young people actually get better all on their own. And what they're doing is going through some period of, I don't know, some people talk about developmental breakdown or, you know, the storm of adolescence. And people have rightly said we mustn't dismiss that as just adolescent turmoil. That's true. We have to take it seriously, but taking it seriously doesn't necessarily mean trying to take it away. And sometimes the kindest thing we can do to young people when they're distressed is sit with them during their distress and let them come out the other side of it to have some kind of completed experience in which they grow. And often when we're intervening to treat young people, we're treating our own anxiety as parents and therapists, not actually treating the young person. Funnily enough, another influential person in my life is somebody called Peter Bruggen, an English adolescent psychiatrist. He ran an adolescent unit in the UK, and they only had one indication for the use of medication in young people there, staff anxiety. They would say to the young person, the staff are becoming very anxious, so we're going to medicate you. And as you can imagine, that led to much lower levels of medication in the unit, but I think it was a very honest way of talking about the most common justification for, honest justification for medicating children is that we're anxious and we feel less anxious when they're medicated. So my paper, I guess, is a plea to see adults, parents and others' role in children's life, not to make them feel good, but to make them good at feelings, to be able to recognise, manage and deal with being angry and sad and frightened, and not always to have this idea that happiness is the aspiration in life. Happiness is a lovely side effect if you happen to be in a good place in your life, but it might not be the right feeling for you to have. It might be much more appropriate for you to be sad or angry or frightened.
Well, I think these are very good points. I like to also stress, though, that, and I think you are doing this, that under all conditions, we need to make the most of the conditions. We need to be in charge of ourselves. We need to be autonomous. We need to assume that we can handle whatever feelings we're going to be having and whatever circumstances life throws at us. So I like to hold up a very strong ideal about who we can be, and that we can also be loving through thick and thin, that we can, you know, work on being rational and loving even while we may be sad or hurt or scared. I put a lot of emphasis in my work on the ideals, you know, of living. I don't know if you do that or not.
Yes, but I mean, I think, you know, coming back to the family and society, societal influences on children, that sometimes, and not in your hands, I'm sure, but, you know, people like Martin Seligman with his positive thinking approach is really negligent of the life circumstances in which some children are. He talks about promoting resilience when what's needed is revolution or at least, you know, a small revolution in the child's life, living in poverty and domestic violence and drugs everywhere, and, you know, the child's supposed to develop resilience in the face of that. So I think that the danger of, you know, promoting the positive is not standing up to the negative in a child's life and advocating very strongly for changes in the circumstances. And I know that's not what you're promoting at all, but I think the danger is that it can be taken and distorted in a way that is insufficiently pro-child, I guess, in the scenario.
I really agree with you 100%. In fact, the mystery book we're talking about has, I think, one of the most in-depth chapters in the book that will be coming out in December on child abuse. It's got a real examination of child abuse and the way it reinforces guilt, shame, and anxiety. And I'm very much with you. You know, my life really has two parts to it in my own work. One is standing up to evil, and the other is promoting good. And I'm happy to be you know, having an opportunity more and more to talk about what is good and how we can live good lives. I'm 100% agreeing with you. I think Martin Seligman and the positive psychology movement, it downplays or ignores or simply doesn't pay attention to the horrors inflicted on children, and it also has no theory of guilt, shame, and anxiety, or no interest in what disrupts positive thinking. So I think you need to be able to look at what interferes with loving, rational approach to life, and how that can be, how those impediments can be overcome. I tend to look at guilt, shame, and anxiety as impediments that are inevitable, but also that we can triumph and transcend over them as much as possible.
Yeah, and notice that we're talking in terms of ordinary emotions, you know, love, anger, shame, guilt. We're not talking about depression and with those psychiatric labels. And, you know, it's amazing with Chinese psychiatrists that they never ask about those ordinary feelings. They either get a really thorough history of depression and anxiety and other sort of pathological feelings, but they don't routinely ask about what's making you angry in your life, what are you frightened of, what are you sad about, what's happening in terms of your love for people and feeling loved by other people. And yet when you do ask about those things, the story falls out.
Oh, yeah, I really agree with you. I mean, what psychiatrists do now, and at least as great an extent to the primary care docs, is they're just trying to find a few key words to justify a drug. The primary docs, I see records that say, in our country, that say nothing more than depression, Paxil, and it's a 12-year-old. I mean, it makes no sense at all. It's just a crime against children that this goes on. One of your interests, which I'd love you to talk about for a few minutes, is about the siblings of children who are disabled or ill. That's a whole new subject for me, and no one's talked about that on the air here. Could you talk a bit about your project?
Yeah, it must be 15 years ago. I was heard about a woman called Kate Strome, who had a sister with a severe intellectual disability. And she'd grown up not knowing really in any meaningful way that there were so many other people who were in the same situation, you know, feeling like she was the only person who was going through what she was going through. Things like needing to be perfect in the family because, you know, mum and dad needed something to make up for having a disabled child. The conflicts of being smarter than her older sister at quite a young age. And she grew up with lots of anxiety and other distressing symptoms. And it was only, and had lots of contact with psychiatry, it was only when she came across a very humane and wonderful therapist who helped her to understand the impact of having to be the perfect child in this family, how that had been so difficult for her, that she began to look around for other people who might be in a similar situation. And so she established a sibling network, and over the years, in spite of a complete lack of interest from government funding bodies, has maintained and developed an organisation called Siblings Australia, which I've been involved with. And you know, this is one of these things that I'm sure some of your listeners are having the same reaction that I did. You know, why didn't I realise, why didn't I think that this would be a big deal? Once you hear about it, you recognise just how sensible it is to think that having a disabled brother or sister might be quite a distressing experience for you. And publicly, lots of people focus on the positive aspects, and there are positive aspects of having a disabled sibling, so that makes people who are suffering all the more feel alone, because they feel like they're, you know, weak or different because they're not feeling the positives that other people are talking about publicly. So through establishing these sibling networks, Kate's been able to support a lot of people who would otherwise be very isolated in their distress. The other thing that happens with siblings is that when parents die, they are left minding their very disabled brothers and sisters, and that's a lifelong responsibility, that being able to support each other through that process, decisions about whether to institutionalise siblings when their parents die, all of these things are very, very challenging, and Kate's been able to help an enormous number of people through that process. So anybody's interested, if you put Siblings Australia into a search engine, there's an American organisation that's quite similar that Kate's been involved with as well.
You know, it's hard enough to be a young person, and then all of a sudden you discover your mother is going to have another baby come into the world, and that is often, well, it is always transformative of the child's life. And in a good situation, the parents are able to find a very positive role for the older sibling and to help them develop positive lifelong bonds. But now if the sibling is born requiring a huge amount of attention, there's the transformation's even more radical, and certainly can have a lot of negative effects on people. We see that in therapy all the time.
And don't we underestimate the role of ordinary siblings in our work? You know, part of the reason why Kate's stuff resonated with me was my own experience of how important my older brothers were to me in getting me through some times when perhaps my parents weren't as available as they might have been. And, you know, we largely neglect the role of siblings in young people's lives except when they're doing something horrible.
Yes, a lot of older siblings more or less raise their younger siblings. We've had a number of families like that. Some youngsters who my wife has helped raise because there was inadequate care at home, and in a couple of occasions the older sibling was taking care of the younger and needed a parent to also get involved who was more active than their own parents. You know, and this is all about life. This is what life's about. It really is all about the stuff of relationship. And psychiatry has completely left that behind. It's so good to hear you as a child psychiatrist talking about this. Do you have many child psychiatrist colleagues? I mean, in this country, child psychiatry is just an arm of the pharmaceutical industry, as far as I can tell. But do you have many colleagues that share your views in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, some who share them completely, many who are closer to our views than they would be to the conventional sort of drug company influence views, some who are like American child psychiatrists are characterised as being. But on the whole, you'd find child psychiatry a more friendly place here than you would in America.
Yeah, this is one of the themes that's come out lately. I've had a number of people on from Great Britain in the last year. And there is definitely more room in Great Britain, and from what I hear in Australia, to really care about children and try to provide them decent services, rather than reflexly diagnose and drug them. I'm not saying, folks, that organized psychiatry is good in any of the Western countries, but it's a little better, I think, just a tad better in Great Britain and Australia. Have you been over? When was the last time you were over in the U.S., John?
That was probably 5 years ago, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping for. Yeah.
We haven't in any way embraced the pediatric bipolar phenomenon in Australia. Almost no primary school age children would ever be diagnosed with bipolar disorder in Australia.
Yeah, it is. It's the lesser drug company influence, because the bipolar diagnosis here is based almost entirely on the work of a few Harvard professors of psychiatry, including Biederman, who were taking tons of money from the drug companies. So it's a direct one-to-one correspondence with drug company power. I'm hoping, folks, to get John to perhaps come over to the U.S. to one of our conferences, you know, check up on empathictherapy.org and check on my website. But we're going to have a conference on the campus of Michigan State University in April of this coming year, 2015. And we're filled up with wonderful, just wonderful presenters. It's going to be a great conference. I'm hoping people from all over the country and the world will come. And I'm hoping that maybe at the last minute John will join us. I'm waiting to hear. I'm not asking him to answer on the air. But I'm hoping he will come and provide a breath of fresh air for American child psychiatry. John, we've got about a minute left. Any concluding thoughts?
Just building on what we've been talking about, it's the message that I always try and get across when I'm teaching, that it's all about stories, feelings, and relationships. And if you stay in that territory and keep your focus on that territory, then you'll come to understand what's going on for your patients.
I think that's wonderful. John Giuridini, thank you so much for being here. And do that, folks. It's about the stories, the feelings, the relationships. Thank you so much for being on the show.